This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for this NPR station podcast comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? You think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really gotta rap and be all that and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, what do the amazingly different but very successful films Crash, Diary of a Mad Black Woman, and Saw have in common? Well, they were all distributed by Lionsgate Entertainment. We'll talk to Lionsgate's vice chair, Michael Burns. Plus, clouds form over Hollywood's labor relations and the most powerful job in show business. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Stick around, it's The Business from NPR. The biggest story this week is news of something that didn't happen. Variety reports that after months of feverish, heavy petting, the love affair between Endeavor and United Talent Agency appears to have broken off without consummation. Endeavor, home to Ben Affleck, Reese Witherspoon, and Adam Sandler, and United Talent Agency, home to Jim Carrey, Vince Vaughn, and Ben Stiller, were to have formed a powerful challenger to the long-dominant Creative Artists Agency. Stay tuned on this one. The musky aroma of romance between agencies is still very much in the air. Elsewhere, Sirius Satellite Radio last week announced that it has settled some nagging complaints from three major record labels, Universal, Warner, and Sony BMG Music. The three companies were freaking out over the new Sirius S50 player, which, as its colorful name suggests, can record up to 50 hours of music played by Sirius. But as the AP noted, quote, terms were not disclosed. You could understand the Satcaster's reticence about revealing what is probably a hefty settlement. In the fourth quarter of last year alone, Sirius lost $311 million. So the question is, will the cost of settling up with the labels outstrip the revenue to be gotten by allowing you to TiVo your radio? We don't know. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, bad news from mega producer Dick Wolf, creator of the seemingly unending permutations of the TV franchise Law & Order. Wolf told a Las Vegas conference packed with telecom executives that a Hollywood labor strike over digital downloading revenue is inevitable, and that TV, at least as it's seen today, could vanish entirely. Quote, it's the perfect storm, Wolf said. We're buying the plywood and getting the water in. In other news, apparently Oprah isn't just bad for James Fry's health. Media reports surfaced last week that older women who say that talk shows and soap operas are their favorite TV shows score poorly on tests of memory and attention. Of course, the jury's still out on whether there's causality. But the study does say that the findings do point to, quote, some association between TV choices and intellectual function. In other words, while Oprah may not be helping any, it might be just as true that you're doing poorly on memory tests in old age because you were never that bright to begin with. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next on The Business, Hollywood's labor pains. When Lou Wasserman came to town 50 years ago, he called on some of his broken-nosed friends from back east to get Hollywood's trade unions in line. Since then, most labor strife in the business has been within the creative guilds. Most recently, actors went out on strike for commercial pay in 2000. And now, a huge cloud hangs over Hollywood labor relations, over money that's not even there yet. It all goes back to the introduction of the VCR in the late 80s. Back then, actors, writers, and directors largely gave away claims on residuals on what they thought would be no big deal. They never imagined that video, and then later DVD, would turn out to be Hollywood's cash cow. Suddenly, it's back to the future all over again. But instead of VCRs, today it's iPods. And the guilds are determined not to lose out on yet another massive windfall. Dave McNary writes about labor for Variety. Dave McNary, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
What is the same about the situation now that we saw in 2000 when we had a strike? It was a different strike. It was a commercial strike instead of a TV and film strike. And what's different?
What's similar is that both the Screen Actors Guild and the Writers Guild have leaderships that were elected on platforms of taking a much more aggressive stance at the bargaining table. Some people would even call it militant. What's different is that both guilds are having to deal with the appearance of new technologies. And the most obvious one is the iPod. And what's happened with that recently is that when the companies came upon the requirement of having to pay the talent for the licensing, the use of their images on these downloads off the iTunes store, they chose to do so at the lower rate, four times lower, the old home video rate, rather than the pay television rate.
So basically, if I'm an actor or a writer and I've got a show on TV, let's say I'm fortunate enough to enjoy the largesse of ABC and Lost,
right?
Or Desperate Housewives, or 24 or whatever.
Yeah.
Basically, there's two different ways I can get paid, right? I get paid a certain amount of money when a show airs on TV, and I get a certain amount of money when a show is sold on home video, right?
Right.
And the difference between the two is about four times, right?
I would get
I get paid about four times more when the show airs on TV as when it hits the video.
That's right.
And basically, what you're telling me is Disney has said, look, we're treating all these iPod downloads as home video.
Exactly.
And naturally, somewhat predictably, the guilds have gone totally bat guano over this.
And that's partly why people are so nervous about it, because obviously these new technologies are getting more and more into use.
Right. It seems like suddenly 1999 has finally arrived just in the year 2006 when the talk was about streaming video and you're going to see TV on little boxes that fit in your shirt pocket. And we're here now, right?
Well, that's part of the guild's dilemma, just as it was 20 years ago when they were trying to figure out where should we make the concession and where should we really go for it. I mean, at this point, they need to figure out what is the technology that's going to become the dominant producer of revenues for the companies.
So guilds sort of need to be psychic.
Right. And in this case, the companies aren't exactly producing a unified front in terms of which particular platform they're going to use. The only thing that they're unified about is that they certainly don't want to pay the guilds at the pay TV rate.
If the companies say, we're only going to pay you for a digital download of Lost or Desperate Housewives, we're only going to pay you on the home video model, well, that's not very fair if it turns out that I'm seeing this show for the first time on my iPod. You know, the fact that I never watched the broadcast that they set up to go over the airwaves and come out with my television, if I've never seen that, I ought to be paid as if this is something that has been produced for me to watch and be paid on that contract. And the obverse of that coin is that if, for instance, I am just an addict and I can't get enough of Terry Hatcher and I'm watching Desperate Housewives for the fifth time on my iPod, well, then that's clearly home video.
I would think that a lot of this is simply going to depend on which business model becomes the most popular. And so that's why it's, again, very difficult for the guilds, because that's sort of what they need to figure out. Where is the money going? It would seem to me that it's going to be real difficult for the guilds to embrace the point of view that this is the same as a home video experience. I don't think there's really a compelling argument out there against that from the guild's point of view, except for the fact that the companies just don't want to pay them the money.
So this has nothing to do with whether or not logically a contract applies. It has everything to do with whether or not we have the power to get what we want.
Yes, absolutely.
As with so many things in
Hollywood. As with so many things.
Okay. So, final question. You think we're going to have a strike?
If you put a gun to my head, I'd say probably not. But that certainly doesn't preclude the possibility.
Dave McNary covers labor and studio film production for Daily Variety. Dave, thanks for being on The Business.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
There are other issues bubbling up from the Hollywood labor tar pit. It's possible that camera operators, the guys that actually take the pictures for the cinematographers, may be put out of work because of a new contract that makes them optional. Working actors are being asked to sign contracts that obligate them to hawk sponsors' products if their TV pilot is picked up by the network. Reality TV is using producers as writers, and the writers are not happy about that. The Business is the show that dares to make Hollywood labor negotiations sexy, so you'll be sure to hear more about these issues in shows to come. But coming up next on The Business, Lionsgate moves from iconoclast to icon. In little more than 5 years, Lionsgate Entertainment has gone from a marginal Canadian indie with no market share to a publicly traded billion-dollar producer and distributor of film, TV, and home video. And in the words of Frank Sinatra, they did it their way, with an unbelievably eclectic array of product. They've made their mark with genre films like the box office sleeper Saw, but also with serious fare like Hotel Rwanda and Monsters Ball. With a profitable and stable business model, they've also been able to make high-risk, high-reward movies like distributing Fahrenheit 9-1-1 when it was too hot for anyone else to handle. It went on to be the highest-grossing documentary of all time. And at a time when Tyler Perry couldn't get arrested in Hollywood, they gave complete creative control to make Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Their $5 million bet turned into a $100 million franchise. Most recently, Lionsgate snatched up Crash, a movie headed straight to video, and took it straight to the Oscars instead. While the studios are panicking over slumping box office and DVD sales, Lionsgate is roaring in both categories. Michael Burns is vice chair of the company. Michael Burns, welcome to The Business.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, congratulations are in order since you managed to upset a lot of people in Las Vegas and win Best Picture for Crash. So, congratulations.
Thanks. I heard the odds at one time were 8-1, so we're happy to actually beat the bookies this time around.
Did you put any money on it?
We're not allowed to do that.
First of all, let's talk about how you won in practical terms. I mean, let's leave aside the aesthetics, and it was a great film. I think all the films that were nominated were great movies. But Annie Proulx, for instance, the author of the short story on which Brokeback was based, launched what is really only described as a screed against a lot of things, but one of them being Lionsgate, and that there, as she put it, quote, and rumor has it that Lionsgate inundated the Academy voters with DVD copies of Crash, a few weeks before the ballot deadline, end quote.
She reminds me of that Gertrude in Hamlet, the lady does protest too much, but every single studio sends DVD copies of their movies to all of the Academy members, which are around 6,000. I think what she's referring to, although she sort of got her facts wrong, is we sent out an aggressive campaign. We sent out 130,000 DVDs to every member of SAG. And frankly, the reason we did that was pretty simple. We thought we had the goods.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, as a strategy, and I don't want to put you in the position of having to defend winning the Oscar here. Certainly, when I say congratulations, I mean it. But since you are this smaller company that is not an oligopoly that is vertically integrated in
sure.
the same way that Viacom and Time Warner are, what kind of films do you have to make in order to be successful?
Well, I'll tell you, I think that what you're referring to is our competitive advantage. We very much have a PT boat mentality as opposed to an aircraft carrier. We move very quickly both on the acquisition front and on the production side. We have an incredible group of individuals that, frankly, that my partner, our CEO, John Feldheimer, and I empower to close. And if you look at what we've produced, if you look at Mike Pasternak, who runs production with an incredible team, the Tyler Perry franchise that we started, when Mike first came in and said, look, let's get in business with Tyler Perry, frankly, a lot of people at the company didn't know who he was. And 5 weeks later, we're in pre-production on his first movie, which was Diary of a Mad Black Woman, which astounded the business when the movie opened at number one. It's the speed with which we can move and execute. And that also applies to Crash. You know, Peter Block, Jason Constantine, all the people in our acquisitions department, they saw and loved Crash and moved very, very quickly to close. I think it's the first movie of an acquisition, maybe all the way going back to there was one other movie, which was Chariots of Fire, I think was an acquisition. But this is the first acquisition to actually be propelled to win the Best Picture Oscar. So I think that whether it be production, whether it be acquisitions, whether it be look at our theatrical business. We're putting together a little movie coming out in a couple weeks, Larry the Cable Guy, which, again, that just dropped in our laps 2 or 3 weeks ago, and here we are going out on 1,200 screens in a couple weeks.
I want to ask you about that. I'm glad you bring up Larry the Cable Guy, which we should use its full title, Larry the Cable Guy, comma, Health Inspector.
That's right.
I just saw the trailer for it last night in which Larry says, "You ever fart so hard you put your back out?" That kind of movie right next to Crash.
Sure.
There is such a wide and broad range of taste and sensibilities there.
You think we've lost our minds?
Well, that's what I want to ask
sure.
you about. I mean,
sure.
is a lot of studios have what is sort of a tastemaker mentality. That is, you hire an executive not just to make sure the trains run on time and to make sure, you know, some auteur doesn't go out and shoot 5 million feet of film and go 60 million over budget, but rather to have a sort of a tastemaker sensibility imposed on the vision for the company. And the vision is so amalgamated and disparate.
Eclectic. I'll tell you, what you have to remember about Lionsgate is we're about niches, and we are about finding films that are going to attract an initial audience. Larry has a very specific audience. Tyler Perry has a very specific audience. They're going to show up the first weekend the movie's in there. A picture like Saw or Saw 2 or House of 1,000 Corpses, those are pictures that we know the initial demographic that we're going to be going for, who's going to show up opening weekend, and then we want to build from that initial group of moviegoers who are going to say, okay, they either have the picture that works or they don't. And so what we feel very strongly about is that whether it be faith-based or whether it be urban, African-American-oriented, or whether it be horror films, or for this example that we're talking about, Larry, we know who we're going to target initially.
Now, Crash doesn't fall into that.
Crash, yeah. Crash is, again, we've had 18 Academy Award nominations. Actually, I think we've had over 20 now. 20 Academy Award nominations in the last 6 years. And Crash was grown-up entertainment. We are very story-oriented. And when we're talking about grown-up entertainment, which is something a little bit more sophisticated, like Crash, what we knew is that we were going to target the art house crowd, the sophisticated, the intelligentsia to show up, to really go after them and to say that this is something to be considered seriously. And that's what we did in Crash. And we've done that over and over again, all the way back to one of the first big successes that we had was Monsters Ball.
As a public company, we should point out that Lionsgate is publicly traded. How do you get away with releasing movies? I mean, you've got Hard Candy coming out, for instance, which is a fascinating movie, but it's one in which a pedophile gets a very, shall we say, violent comeuppance.
Well, you're not sure he's a pedophile, so I don't want to give away the movie, but I will tell you this. That movie is disturbing as hell. And what we have is, I'll tell you, to get back to your question, we're not afraid of controversy. You know, controversy creates publicity. And the nice thing that we like about publicity is it's free and it doesn't cost it's not like buying a $400,000 or $500,000 30-second spot on Lost.
Even bad publicity.
Well, bad publicity. I don't know really what that means. I mean, as far as we've come out with – we certainly got attacked. Look, I'm an anomaly. I'm a Republican actually in the entertainment business. But we came out with Fahrenheit 9/11. We're attacked from, a lot of different directions.
Given what we just saw for the last 10 years, where all the media companies spent all this time absorbing left and right all kinds of cable companies and media operations and internet and online, does Lionsgate plan to become – a major media company as defined by a Viacom or a Time Warner? Do you want to have a video game division? Do you want to have a cable company? Do you want to vertically integrate? Or is that a model that just holds no interest for you?
We'd like to be the smallest studio with the biggest library.
This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser. After a short break, more with the vice chair of the genre-bending, super-successful mini-studio, Lionsgate Entertainment. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser. Lionsgate Entertainment picked up Crash when everyone else in Hollywood passed, and it went on to win the Oscar for Best Picture. The genre-bending, super-successful mini-studio is breaking Hollywood's rules and prospering while many other studios founder. Michael Burns is Lionsgate's vice chair. When we look at the numbers right now, the state of the industry is perilous, to say the least. Big confab held a few weeks ago. All the major studios send their distribution guys there, their exhibition chain executives, all the movie theater guys get together in Las Vegas. And the consensus is, looking at the numbers, 9% down worldwide revenue. Why is the movie business seemingly in such trouble, in your opinion, in your judgment?
Well, I'd say that it reminds me a little bit of that Mark Twain quote when they were trying to looking for him, and he was writing one of his last books, and he'd heard a rumor that he was dead, and he said, stories of my death are greatly exaggerated. I think what's happened is that we had a bumpy year as an industry with a lot of pictures that didn't work. And remember that you're talking about enormous costs. You're talking about the average motion picture plus the budgeting over $100 million. But you need to understand that's not the Lionsgate model. And if you said to me, how is your business theatrically? Well, look at our market share. We've gone from basically zero to close to 5% of the theatrical box office. Yes, we had the industry itself dipped last year, but I think we have a pretty good slate, not only on the Lionsgate side, but also some of the majors. If I look at the schedule coming out, there's some pretty exciting projects out there.
Is your box office up?
Oh, significantly.
We're almost out of time here, but I want to ask you one last quick question. Everyone seems to think there's going to be a strike, that there is a fundamental disagreement and a violent disagreement between the writers and the actors of Hollywood who want to be paid essentially on a production contract. And that's a fancy way of saying that there's two different contracts that can be used to pay you if you're a performer or a writer. And one of them is a distribution contract and one of them is a production contract. The difference for people who don't follow this that closely is about, you know, on one being the producing contract, you get paid about four times more. There seems to be, at least at ABC, the feeling that there is no way, at Disney and ABC, there's no way that we're going to pay that favorable contract to the guilds. And the guilds seem to be thinking, like, there is no way that we're going to accept that. Everyone seems to think we're headed for a strike. Do you think we're headed for a strike?
A strike is possible. I don't think it's likely. But then again, this is a business of surprises.
Michael Burns is the vice chairman of Lionsgate Entertainment. Michael, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on The Business, let's do lunch. In Hollywood, business is done at lunch. And one of the places where Hollywood does lunch is Barney Greengrass, at the top floor of the very chic Barney's department store in Beverly Hills.
Barney Greengrass. Sure, how many?
This very upscale deli has beautiful rooftop seating and a small white dining room surrounded on two sides by windows. Every table seems nice enough, but seating Hollywood's lunch crowd is a little like running the flight deck on an aircraft carrier. An awful lot is going on at once, and there's always a sense of impending disaster. We sat down with Barney Greengrass General Manager Sharon Kirvin in the corner table usually reserved for celebrities just before the lunch rush. Sharon Kirvin, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
Walk me through, what happens, what's your perfect storm? What happens when, a major producer comes in, major agent walks in? Who gets preference? Is it the regulars who get the preference or the guys who, that guy's a gross player? How do you juggle all the chainsaws and bowling balls? It's got to be high stress.
For us, our regular customers are our bread and butter, the ones who come in, some of them every day. But then you have the celebrity who might walk in without making a reservation. I should stress, though, that we do try to hold tables for walk-in customers. We don't want to keep them waiting because for us it's really about trying to get everyone in. And it's hard when our regulars, high-profile regulars, are all trying to come on the same day. Because as you see, what's considered for us are our high-end tables, there's only five.
I see a bunch of tables. Which ones are the important tables? Is it the ones with the good sight lines? And which ones are those?
Right. Basically, it's the tables that have the good sight line that are more towards the back of the dining room so they can see from a distance who's coming in. that row right there where the windows are and this one right here where we are. This one particularly is good. We tend to put celebrities here because they're kind of hidden. They're tucked away a little bit. So you can't really notice they're here until you're all the way in the room. Then you can maybe notice they're here.
So part of the reason is that they want to be able to scan the room and see who they need to pick off later and
or avoid.
It seems like to your average diner, you'd want the table with a nice view. And I have to point out here, since we're on the radio, there's a hell of a nice view if you bother to look over your shoulder, or even just if you're, depending on where you're sitting, you look out and you can see basically all of Los Angeles.
For them, the view is not through the window. It's who's coming in.
So walk me through some of your stickier situations. What for you is a send for backup kind of call? Like, we've got Brian, I don't want to use any names, but you've got, as they say in the rental car business, Brian Grazer or similar. We've got an Angelina Jolie or similar. We've got an agent of some kind, or, you know, a Swifty Lazar type, whether it's Jim Wyatt or Jim Burkus, or you name the Jim, coming in all at once. Who do you take first?
You have to wing it. For us, luckily, our regulars make reservations. Most of the celebrities make reservations. If we know they're coming in advance, we can pre-juggle. You saw some of that earlier. We have to pre-juggle around where people are going. And then if you get that wrench thrown into it when someone does walk in that is a regular or a celebrity or someone that you want to accommodate for whatever reason, and you have not held a table for that person, that's when it's difficult. You have to sort of, sometimes they have to wait.
You know, for our listeners in New York, constantly I'll go to New York and people will say, well, when do you want to have lunch? And it's a bit, you know, it stops you as an Angelino, because especially somebody who works in entertainment, lunch is, you don't even have to ask, what time is lunch?
Well, 1 o'clock.
What do you do when everyone agrees that only 1 hour of the day is the time to conduct the business lunch?
Like today, since we're booked obviously at 1 o'clock, we go into overbook, we try to encourage people to come later. And given the nature of traffic, LA traffic, and meeting up with clients that you're having lunch with, oftentimes it is 1:30 before they get in here anyway. But that 1 o'clock time slot does fill up first every day.
What's the cell phone policy here?
It got so overwhelming at one period of time. You'd have everyone in here on Blackberries and on cell phones. And coming up to the host stand, if they come up to the host stand on a cell phone, even if they have an earpiece, we don't even talk to them until they're off the phone. But that doesn't happen that much anymore. More and more you see people not even coming in with their cell phones.
What else have you noticed?
I noticed too, the lunches are longer, and people tend to have a glass of wine and take their time with it. I also notice them tending to have more fun with it. It's not so much stress than it was before. I don't know why. Maybe our clientele has evolved to a point where it's a little more relaxed, not so cutthroat, or maybe these people are the established people. I don't know, and they don't have to fight to be so competitive. I'm not real sure. All I know is I notice people are taking their time, coming in earlier or coming in later and staying longer. They tend to be much more relaxed and subdued. There's not a lot the air is much more, seems calmer, much less stressful, much more relaxed.
That's probably because show business is in really bad shape right
now. Is that what it is?
Yeah, probably.
Well, they're so far gone, then why worry about it? Let's have a glass of wine. And
anyway, Sharon Kirvin is general manager of Barney Greengrass in Beverly Hills, with her finger on the carotid artery of Hollywood power. Sharon, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holtzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com, keyword The Business. You can also podcast the show at KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser. We'll see you next week on The Business.